My name is Tony Curtis. I am an assistant editor with the Civil War Governors of Kentucky Digital Documentary Edition at the Kentucky Historical Society.
And that project, I know, is just coming online now or beginning to, but I know it has a longer history. So can you give us a little bit of background on what the Kentucky Civil War Governors Project is?
Most definitely. It grows out of a long tradition of publishing selected papers of past governors. Most of those have been 20th century governors, and usually about 100 documents are reproduced in a printed, edited volume. When we initially started talking about Civil War governors, this was the template we were going to follow, do a selected volume one of the editors had proposed. And we thought that this was an opportunity to really jump into doing it right, doing it in the 21st century,
sure,
and making it accessible and usable for scholars of all types. So we started planning in 2009, I do believe, and it wasn't until about 2012 that we really started going out into the archives and doing document identification and collecting data and scanning documents. So what the digital platform allows us to do is not to do only a selected group of 100 documents. We have contacted 6,000 repositories and asking them for feedback on what types of collections they have that might be related to Kentucky's governors, received about a 25-30% response rate from those repositories, and we'll be systematically going out and engaging these archives like we have here at the Filson Historical Society last year, identifying documents, scanning those, and going through a full editing process. As of the moment, we have 10,000 documents online. Our projections originally were 25,000 total documents. We currently have 23,000 documents collected and that are in some part of the process, with a projection of 40,000 plus documents at this point. So if going from 100 selected in a printed edition that sits on a shelf somewhere to being accessible all over the world and having every document related to Kentucky's Civil War governors from Lincoln's election, November 1860, to the end of slavery, December 1865.
So when you talk about either these earlier versions of this where it was 100 selected items being published or this project, what are we talking about? We're talking about letters to and from the governor or decrees? What kind of documents actually make up this project, or what kind of documentary heritage does a governor leave behind?
That was something that we really needed to explore, and we spent the first several years really doing some. There were some research trips to the National Archives, to NARA, to the state archives in Kentucky, and our own archives at the Kentucky Historical Society. And I think Daryl and Beth even came over to the Filson initially and did kind of a dry run. So finding out what the scope was of the types of documents. A lot of documentary editing projects focus on one individual. We're focusing on five individuals, so three Union governors and two Confederate governors. So that automatically broadens the scope quite a bit. And a lot of those documentary editions, especially the Founding Fathers editions, deal with correspondence. They have some financial documents or diaries, and that's really the scope of their types of documents they have. In our project, we have not only correspondence, financial records, legal records, we have pardon files, we have especially those coming through the state government at the Kentucky Department of Libraries and Archives. That is a large collection of files. We didn't expect all the petitions that would come with that, all the correspondence, all the appointments, all the commissions. So the official papers really broadens the types of documents that the governors are exchanging, from a military perspective, communicating all the way up and down the chain of command at the federal and state levels, communicating with constituents across the state, petitioning. So you're really getting a good lay of the land from multiple areas of Kentucky and really broadening that historical landscape of documents mm-hmm. that are available. So it's a wide variety. And what we always say is this project is about the governors of Kentucky, but it's really about adding all the historical actors and broadening the amount of historical actors we understand in Civil War era Kentucky. So it's really about the people of Kentucky.
Right. So it's not that somebody is going to come to us or come to you, to your project, and say, I'm interested in this governor. It's I'm interested in what kind of petitions the governor was receiving. I'm interested in the political orientation of the people around the governor. Yeah, so it seems it seems pretty clear that it quickly goes beyond just
it does.
The governors.
It does. And you get some correspondence as fun between governors and who will become governor. So James Robinson and Bramlett are corresponding sometimes, which is kind of fun. Depending on, like Robinson, a large portion of his military correspondence stops in October of 1862 when the invasion of Kentucky occurs. We're not really sure what happens to his correspondence after that. If it, a lot of documents were transported to Louisville during that time on a train, what happened to those, we don't know.
Sure.
But it is. It's really about the people who are corresponding. It's really about broadening the understanding of Civil War era Kentucky and really digging down into those social networks that exist in the Civil War era.
Okay. So even though it's about much more than these governors,
mm-hmm.
why don't we tell our listeners who those governors were if they can't reel them all off the top of their head?
Most people can't, so...
Right. Bramlett is the only one I could easily just bring right to mind. And when you say Union governors and Confederate governors, of course, define what you kind of mean by that as well.
Most definitely. So we have five governors. We have three Union and two Confederate governors. From the Union side, we have Beriah McGoffin, who's from Harrodsburg, Mercer County, Kentucky. He is governor through much of the initial aspects of Kentucky's involvement in the Civil War, 1859, up until 1862, when he actually resigns from the governorship. There is a very sketchy transition of power that occurs. We call it almost a coup d'etat, because James Robinson is not even in the picture, and McGoffin only agrees to resign when he basically can designate his successor. So John Fisk is the speaker, is next in line. There's no lieutenant governor. Lynn Boyd dies in 1859. He doesn't want John Fisk because he's a New York abolitionist, is what he always says. And he only agrees that if Fisk steps down, Robinson can step in. He will resign. Robinson becomes governor, and then Fisk becomes the speaker again. So there's this strange dealing that really goes around that. Yeah. Beriah McGoffin definitely has Southern sympathies. He's pro-Union, and he's pro-slavery, but he's always perceived as having Southern sympathies. Robinson, much the same, comes to power in 62, goes through the invasion of Kentucky right as he comes into the governorship in August of 62, and serves for a year. He goes through the emancipation process in Kentucky, how Kentucky responds to emancipation, and in 63, he's from Scott County, Kentucky. Thomas Bramlett is elected governor of Kentucky, and he serves out the rest of the war until 1867. Bramlett is also a strong Democrat, a strong Unionist, and a strong supporter of slavery in Kentucky. He is initially opposed to black enlistment in the Union Army and fights that battle rather publicly throughout 63, 64, and into 65, and eventually is to the point of really taking credit for having all these African-Americans in Kentucky sign up for the military, because then he's thinking, oh, it's countering the need for white enlistment to meet our quotas for the state, and make several speeches on that. So Bramlett is an interesting character. You see some interesting pardons from him, and he's actually really good about explaining the legal background of pardons. So he's pretty active. But then I say we have two Confederate governors. We do. We have George W. Johnson, who initially is from Scott County, Kentucky, and is the first provisional governor of Kentucky, and then Richard Halls, who is from Bourbon County. Kentucky forms a provisional government. It exists as an entity. It never really functions as an entity. It spends most of its time basically following the Confederate Army, especially after the 1862 invasion back into Tennessee, and they follow the Army for the rest of the war, more or less. Johnson actually joins with the Confederate Army at Shiloh and is killed at Shiloh, which spurs Richard Halls to be named governor of Kentucky. Halls had a long history of being involved with politics in Kentucky, involved with the provisional government in Russellville, and actually is brought to power and inaugurated in Frankfort in 1862 when they have overtaken the capital. That lasts for a few hours, and he's run out of town, and he basically follows the Confederate government, and he's in Tennessee, he's in Virginia, he spends his... You don't really hear much from him, and the interesting part at this point in the project is Most of our documents are from the three Union governors. We have the George W. Johnson papers at the Kentucky Historical Society, which gives us about 150 to 200 documents to go through, 100 of which are in scope. Richard Hall's, I think we have 8 or 10 documents at this point. Okay. So we're sure some will come through the National Archives through the Confederate collection and maybe private hands at some point in time, but it's definitely not an equal balance of number of documents at this point in time.